de la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means
necessary. This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
All right. Good morning, everybody. My name is Dawn Oliver Ramsey. I use she, her pronouns. I'm from Kansas City, Missouri. I am honored to be here this morning with such an amazing panel of organizers and activists around the country and primarily concentrated in what is considered the rural South. Today, we're here to talk to you about some really, really pressing issues in the death penalty space. I, again, am Dawn. I'm going to kick it off by introducing this amazing panel and allow them to share a little bit with each of you about who they are, where they're from, and the work that they're doing across the country. And I will start at this end and go to the end, or go work from this end down. So, Faronda, would you like to start?
Sure. My name is Faronda Brassfield. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
My name's Faronda Brassfield. I'm the Director of Leadership Development for the Eighth Amendment Project. Our group helps to coordinate national death penalty strategy. I also work with leaders of color in the death penalty movement to help to make sure that we are connected, that we are supported, that we are able to share information with each other and work together. I've been a death penalty advocate since 2015, and this is some extremely, extremely hard work. It's often siloed away from other criminal legal work, and so today I hope that you guys will understand why the death penalty matters, why it's important, how it relates to other criminal legal issues and issues of social justice. And other issues of social justice. I also wanted to, just as a disclaimer, we had this fabulous, fantastic PowerPoint that we've been working really hard on, and we don't have a screen or anything to put it on. So bear with us today because we are modifying our presentation as we came in and saw that we don't have a screen. So thank you so much. Really excited to share with you today.
Good morning, friends. How y'all feeling? Okay. I'm a Southern girl, I'm a call and response girl, and my toddler kept me up to like 1 a.m. last night, so I might need some of y'all's energy, if that's cool. So I'm gonna ask y'all what's up. How y'all feeling this morning? Okay, do we got some people from the South in here? All right, it's good to see you, comrades. Good to see everyone. Thank y'all so much for being here. My name is Sherelle Brown, I go by they, she pronouns, and I'm a director of organizing with DSP. I've been doing work around anti-black state violence for about 15 plus years. I grew up in a small town at the border of North Carolina and South Carolina called Laurinburg. Anyone ever heard of Laurinburg? Okay, I'm impressed because people from North Carolina haven't even heard of Laurinburg. It's often referred to as the bathroom break on the way to Myrtle Beach. Growing up in this rural town where there wasn't a lot of opportunities, but there were a lot of jails, really helped shape in my politic. You also may see me at this conference at some point with my kid, Fox, who is 3. He's on the spectrum, and it also informs how I organize for our young folks, for black kids who are already born with disadvantages. And he also doesn't respect my work, so he may at any point take off running or just ignore me altogether. We assume him right now, but he's nonverbal, so hasn't told us different yet. And I'm really excited to be up here with my colleagues and comrades who've been doing amazing work in this space. A lot of my work is around connecting the death-making institution of the death penalty with other broader work around mass incarceration and criminal justice. I am an abolitionist, so that's where all my politics are formed from. Okay, I hear some snaps, some whoops. Currently I'm in between New York and Atlanta. So really excited to talk to y'all about the work. I often say that I am Southern by birth, but queer by grace. And just really happy to be with y'all this morning.
What a wonderful day for the revolutionaries. It's great to see you all. My name is Tiara Cooper. My pronouns are she, her, and I am the managing director of In Defense of Black Lives based in Dallas. I'm also the deputy director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. In Defense of Black Lives is a black queer feminist, formerly incarcerated led organization. We focus on weakening a carceral state, ending mass incarceration, and liberating the oppressed. My work at TCADP is in the name. We work to abolish the death penalty. And I'm formerly incarcerated. That's how I enter into the work as a black formerly incarcerated woman. And I do this work knowing that there are women and men and people on the inside that need us. And so I'm a voice for the voiceless. This is why I do the work that I do. My day-to-day work typically looks like finding more people like myself and those who want to join us in this work to end mass incarceration amongst many other issues. We know that in the intersections are so many of the issues that we're going to name today. So thank you all for joining us today. And I'm going to kick it off to my wonderful comrade.
Good morning, all. So I am just honored to be in this space and to be with my sisters and comrades. My name is ML Smith. I am co-director of Missourians to Abolish the Death Penalty. I am based in St. Louis, Missouri, born and raised. I have a lot of titles. I am formerly incarcerated. I am an abolitionist as well. I'm Pan-African, and I also tell people I'm a Jacksonian, George, not Andrew. I am in this space to shake some things up, to amplify the inhumanity happening to my people, and defend black, poor, marginalized people. So that's kind of where I stem from. I also, as well, found an organization called Missouri Justice Coalition, and we're creating a statewide prison movement in Missouri that has never existed, but that's the work we're doing. And I just show up every day for my people, so really glad to see y'all here. Hopefully some more people trickled in, and we're going to talk about Khalifa today and all of our work, so really just, you know, appreciative for all you all getting up this morning with us.
Thank you. So before we get started, can y'all just give it up for this panel of badasses real quick? Thank you. Yes. So I just want to check in with this group and just ask, and we can popcorn this unless everybody, you know, I want to respect time, but let's see what we can get through. Can you tell this room, like, why is organizing in the South important? And why is that, and more specifically, why is that significant with respect to organizing in the North? What are we experiencing that maybe our comrades across the country are not? And why is your work organizing in the South important?
You want to start?
You go ahead, Real.
So I'll start off, because okay. I'm typically our historian our Noose to Needle, where we show how the death penalty really is just transcendence of racial terror lynching. But we don't have to look any further than the U.S. Constitution to see that our country's problem with valuing black and brown lives, and specifically the South, has always been present. With the Three-Fifths Compromise, that's Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, that indicated that enslaved individuals only counted for 3/5 of a person. That clause was later replaced by the 14th Amendment, which for years continued to exclude Native Americans as persons recognized for representation. So in many areas and municipalities, once slavery was over, what we saw in the South is this transcendence in the creation of what we now know as the criminal legal system. And it was created as a form of social control. And we all know that our criminal legal system really is just social control to keep capitalism in place. But that's where we saw that in the South, is where it originated. We originated with the black codes. which were codes that were just specifically for Black people. If you didn't have a work contract at the beginning of the year, you could be taken off to prison and be subject to convict leasing, which a lot of people say convict leasing was worse than slavery, because these corporations that the states were leasing their convicts out to, they had no incentive in making sure that people were healthy, that people were enslaved people were healthy, or that they even lived. And so let me scoot over. Can I scoot over closer to you, Sherelle? Can you hear me better now?
Can we agree, like, if we're having problems hearing, that in the room we'll just do like this to ask the speakers to speak up? Is that helpful? Thank you.
Thank you. And I apologize that you weren't able to hear me earlier. But, when we talk about the death penalty, we got the death penalty because the South wanted to sanitize lynchings. It didn't look good. The Southern problem that they were having with wanting to keep people in line. And people were being lynched for all manner of things. Emmett Till was lynched because allegedly he whistled at a white woman. There were plenty of people that were lynched just because they dared to own businesses or to compete with white business owners in those areas. And what happened with the actual death penalty is that states said, no, we cannot have this lynching. We can't have you doing this. This looks bad. So what we will do is that we will use the state and the powers of the state to go out and get these people. We will give them a sham of a trial. And many times in the same day, people were arrested, they had a trial, and they were executed. And so that's how we got the death penalty. That's where the origins of our current criminal legal system come from. And that's, in my opinion, why the South is so important as far as origins. And I'll pass the mic to my colleagues.
So I will quickly follow that up with saying, you know, today, 2024, organizing the South, and again, I do prison work, so every conversation I have is about incarceration. Real quick, I don't know where I'm at. I go to Pride, right? And when I go to Pride, you know what I say? Y'all know it's gay people in prison. And sometimes they look at me like I'm crazy. Y'all know gay folks on death row. Y'all know we executed a trans woman 2 years ago. So those are the conversations I'm always having. But when we talk about the South and talk about incarceration in particular today, it is very much a stranglehold. Like, even people incarcerated, they have all of these control mechanisms where they can hardly... not even organized, you know, just like even communicate. They stopped, you know, physical mail from going in. A year and a half ago, they stopped in our state us from being able to order books from Amazon to send to our loved ones. And when I asked about it, they told us that we're hijacking Amazon packages and putting drugs in them, right? This is what they actually said. So, like, they're trying to do everything to make sure that they have a control mechanism over our people. And our people are so... you know, hopeless, so downtrodden, you know, so exhausted, they're having a difficult time fighting back, even on the inside. And people like me, you know, we're trying to explain, hey, we're here, we're trying to fight on this side as well. But when you're dealing with the system that was embedded in enslavement, embedded in the killing, murder, and control of our people, it's very hard to get folks to even stand up to these issues. I talked to comrades like from Michigan Department of Corrections, and they're like, ain't no, we would never put up with the stuff y'all putting up with down in Missouri prisons or Georgia prisons. But their mindset has always been different. So I think that, like, historically, of course we have post-traumatic slave syndrome, et cetera, just in the South and organizing, you know, within the prison and us trying to do it outside to support the people incarcerated. It's definitely an uphill battle because we've been so brainwashed, we've been so controlled, we've been so manipulated and indoctrinated that even trying to, like, you know, get to the place of we're fighting back, it's hard to get there. So the South, you know, has always been, like Faronda said, that first wave of control, that the first place that all of these issues are created and programs, et cetera, are created to oppress us, to control us, to indoctrinate us, and then it spreads everywhere else. So that, you know, that saying, oh, no, so goes the South, so goes the rest of the nation, is very true.
I'll just follow up from my comrade that there is a deep disconnect regionally, especially in the state of Texas as it relates to organizing. What work in Chicago will not work in Dallas, Texas. What work in California will not work in Texas. And I think it's vital to have that type of understanding and an analysis and assessment of where we're organizing and what we're talking about, right? Another thing I want to name is that there is typically, as it relates to the death penalty, there's this belief that the death penalty is obsolete. In several states, the death penalty has been abolished. But in states like Texas, the death penalty is used constantly. Yes, we have seen a decrease in executions. Yes, we have seen our work pay off, but we have not seen a revolution as it relates to capital punishment. I also say that in cities like Dallas, Austin, Houston, a lot of the cities of which I've organized in, there's a level of fear mongering that, I mean, you see it, you witness it. And with that, yes, there is a wave of control. Yes, there is a wave of oppression, but there is also a wave that I have been experiencing of people that want to get organized. They are fed up and they want to do something about it. They want to have a hand in their own liberation. So I don't want to just sit up here and talk about, you know, what's going wrong in the South. I also want to name there's a wave of resistance. The people are getting up and fighting. The people want to learn how to share their story. I'm formerly incarcerated, so that's a part of the process. We have to go down to the Texas legislature and meet with folks like Greg Abbott. Like, there's a deep wave of resistance, too, that I feel the need to name. I'm gonna stop there.
I don't know if I have too much to add to those brilliant points. You know, as someone more brilliant than me says often, you know, as the South goes, so does the nation. And as my favorite poet, Andre 3000, said, the South got something to say. And so I often, particularly around election times, y'all, we hear these jokes on Twitter, right, where folks are like, oh, give up on the South. It's a conservative stronghold. You know, let's like wash Florida away. Let's wash Georgia away, right? This kind of joke that happens every election season, right? And so instead of thinking the South has a conservative right-wing stronghold, I often think about the South represents areas in which white supremacists and capitalist structures are most deeply entrenched, right? But where also our Black people are. And so we can't afford to write off entire geopolitical regions where our folks are because it looks hard to organize. And there's also tremendous opportunities to build progressive political power in the South, y'all. The South is home to 105 counties that have a Black majority, right? And so we're experimenting every day on the local level, things that we can scale up and show our comrades in Chicago and New York and California, particularly around Cop City. I know we're gonna get to it later, but y'all might've heard of something about Cop City. And so there's lessons to be learned around how folks in Atlanta have been showing up and fighting back. Because currently there's 69 projects across the nation that are about building up police training facilities. And so we have something to both learn from folks, but also show the world. And so I'm really excited to also for y'all to be hearing four different Southern dialects. It's pretty my favorite part of this panel. I'll stop there.
No, thank you all for that. And I know, Haronda, you touched a little bit on it, but let's just talk briefly about the history of the death penalty and then kind of like relate that to what modern executions are looking like and what are the parallels we're seeing with how we got here and how it's going.
So when we started with the death penalty, it was something that was exclusively used for African Americans. And it was exclusively used as a means of social control for the formerly enslaved. What we have seen now is that that racial disparity has not gone anywhere. African Americans make up about 17% of the population, about 13% of the population, but 41% of the people that are on death row. More than 75% of death row defendants who have been executed were sentenced to death for killing white victims, even though in a society as a whole, about half of all homicide victims are African Americans. You see that that valuation that the system just automatically puts on white life versus the the inverse, what the lack of value that the system puts on Black life. In Arkansas, where I'm from, we did a study, and it shows that African Americans are over 2 times more likely to get the death penalty for a capital crime versus their white counterparts, who are going to get the more lenient sentence. So you got two people, a white person and a Black person, that are both committed a capital crime. Being Black really and literally could mean life or death. The Black person is over 2 times, that's almost 3 times more likely to be killed by the state because of the color of your skin. And it goes on and on and on. Is when we talk about cruel and unusual punishment, we talk about the botched executions. 75% of the botched executions in Arkansas were Black people, and Black people only accounted for 33% of all the executions. In Georgia, 86% of the botched executions are Black people, when Black people only account for 30% of the executions in Georgia. And then the same thing in Oklahoma, 83% of the botched lethal injections in Oklahoma were Black people, when Black people only accounted for 30% of the executions. And so what we see as a form of social control against African Americans right after slavery and during and through Jim Crow, we see that today, but we see that with the modern day death penalty. And so that's kind of how we have transcended this practice. And this is something that I want to point out too. It's not just the death penalty. These practices of social control, they seem to morph and to just change into something that's a little more acceptable now. And I think that's we've gone from slavery, enslavement of whole people, into mass incarceration. And so I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but okay. I do. We want to talk about that as well, and how that relates.
So the death penalty. So I kind of want to start talking about the death penalty, even at the historical to today, to kind of talking about a few myths, right? Because, I kind of love grounding people in what the system of capital punishment is. Capital punishment is a political tool. It's nothing that helps the families of the victim. It's nothing that gets justice for that victim's family nor their community. It is only a political tool used by those in power to get what they want, either their career aspirations. Sometimes they're just horrible people that like, to see marginalized folks killed, etc. It's never about the people. It's never about the crime. It's never about the victim. It is always about policy. And also when we talk about crime, because when you just mentioned, Faronda, too, about crime, just want to, center that, ground that as well. Crime is a concept that it was created, right? So when we commit crime, it is crime. But those in power commit violence and crime upon us every single day, right? And it's legal. And it's policy, and we have to abide by it. In Kansas City this past year, there was a 70-year-old man who was getting evicted out of his home, okay? And he was sickly, he was elderly, and obviously he wasn't paying his rent. The sheriff and a process server went to evict this man, and obviously because of how he was feeling and being afraid to be homeless, he killed the sheriff and the process server, which of course is not okay, right? However, them trying to evict him was violence, right? That is violence, especially a 70-plus-year, and this man was white actually, a 70-plus-year-old man who's afraid to be homeless, trying to evict him, he felt his life endangered. And after this happened, the prosecutor in Jackson County, which is Kansas City, Missouri, decides to seek the death penalty against a 70-year-old man who was literally afraid for his own life. She's not doing that for any other reason other than a political purpose. So that's what, I try to make sure we understand, that it's never about the victim and never about the families. It's always a political choice that our system actors make in order to get some point across, which is horrible, to understand. But that's kind of, how that hierarchical balance happens. When people on the lower rungs commit violence against somebody higher, we're always punished. But the people up higher can literally do anything they want to us, as we're seeing right now, right? And of course, I want to, make sure I say Free Palestine. But as we see right now, even in Palestine, those people are able to kill, commit complete genocide, and it's okay. right? But the Palestinians are not supposed to defend themselves, or they're not supposed to be upset because they're being, you know, exterminated and thrown off of their land. So those power dynamics always dictate what crime is, what the definition of crime is, and what legal is. There was a time, of course, when the enslavement of my people was legal, and that was okay. So I just kind of wanted to ground that and also talk about, with the death penalty, how it's always arbitrary, how it's always a political choice. And it's something that we need to understand, because even if, you know, I'm sure a lot of people in this room probably have lost loved ones. I have, and I'm sure other people as well. But we need to understand that using the state apparatus, right, using the state to enact, quote unquote, revenge, is not the way to heal, is not the way to grieve, is not the way to get anything, any emotions that you're feeling either dealt with or taken away, because it's not going to happen. And using the state apparatus, using state forces, using state control against us is never going to fix anything. So we really need to understand that, you know, using capital punishment is not a solution to anything that we're dealing with. I've dealt with a lot of victims' families, and they're not going to get any healing or any help because a person is on death row that you know, harmed their loved one. And of course we need to not use the system overall, but just wanted to kind of talk about how the death penalty is this tool that is used to keep us in a certain place. And you know, I always hear things about, like, well, the death penalty is a deterrent for other crimes. There has not been one story, one study, one article written, anything about a person that was about to kill somebody else and stopped and thought to themselves, oh, I can get the death penalty, so let me not do that. That has never happened, right? I've never seen it reported anywhere, but that's what they tell us is a deterrent. It's not a deterrent. What is a deterrent actually to do is to keep the citizens, keep the community, keep them under control. And to make sure that they know you can always call the powers that be, the police, you know, the government, in order to enact any type of revenge or any type of violence upon your neighbor or upon another poor person or marginalized person in your community. So just kind of wanted to, like, you know, ground us in a few of those myths so that we don't, you know, go around in this room, probably not, but you can also take it to your loved ones. And when they tell you things like, oh, well, the death penalty is something that the victim's family wants. It is not. The police introduced that thought into their head. The police always say, and this, someone told me this a few years ago, after their loved one was killed and the police came to investigate, even before they found the person who did it, the police told this family, when we get them, we're going to put them on death row. Right, and that's stuck in their family's head from that day forward. So this is not something the families want. It is something that the system introduces, and the system is a political tool that they use to make sure that they remain in control of our minds. And so just want to, you know, let you all know that, and you can take those lessons and, you know, debunk those myths in your own community.
Something about Texas that I would like to add as it relates to capital punishment. Texas is one of the only states that during capital trials, they ask the question around future dangerousness, where there's this probability if this person who's on trial will commit harm, violence, or danger in the future. And typically, as we know, the people that serve on these trials do not look like the dominant people that are on death row. Death row is made up of almost half black men. And so when I think of Texas, I always think of this future dangerousness question that almost mirrors in many ways to me risk assessment tools that we see. And if you're doing bail reform work, if you understand the questions that they ask you when you're being booked in, I know what that looks like. And they're asking you where you come from, what's your economic status, what crimes have you committed in the past, and based off of how you answer those questions, which typically have a whole lot more to do with where you come from and what you look like, what zip code you were brought up in, than what you actually did, what crime you actually committed. And if you rank low on that risk assessment tool, you are more likely to do time versus coming home that day. That same question and almost almost identical is being asked during capital trials. So they're running black and brown people through a system and asking, will these people commit crime in the future? And almost all the time, they are convicted in the state of Texas, and death is on the table. There comes a point where they say, you know, this is a, we can either do life or we can put them on death row. So I think it's important that we take that future dangerousness. Not every state has that question, but the state of Texas does. And there's a really critical campaign in case that we're operating in right now for Robert Roberson. He's not a black or brown man, but he is a autistic man who's been on death row for over 20 years under the debunked shaken baby syndrome. Scientific data supports that shaken baby syndrome is not a thing. After his daughter, Nikki, she passed, unfortunately. CPS gets involved. He's an autistic man. He's not responding emotionally the way that the cops, the way that the medical professionals believe he should be responding. And because of that, Robert Roberson is on death row fighting for his life. He has an execution date mid-October. So I wanted to name what death penalty looks like in the state of Texas right now. It still looks like majority black people on death row. That's what the landscape looks like. We still have people who are on death row even when there has been scientific data to throw out any components of their case. And I feel like we need to shed light because most people think, oh, that's out. We've already debunked that. That's out the way, but there's no retroactivity to it. And I also want to shout out Danita. Say, hey, Danita. Danita does a lot of great work in the city of Dallas, and I'm connected with Danita through some cannabis reform work, weed reform work, we call it weed. And there's no retroactivity there. There's a ballot initiative going on in Dallas right now where we're literally just asking for marijuana to not be criminalized in the city of Dallas. But we, even when, once we get this thing passed, because I do believe we will, we're now having to advocate for retroactivity. What's going to happen to the people who are already in jail right now for marijuana offenses? I bring that to the forefront because that's what we're dealing with. I don't think people often take these concepts. You see these articles, you see, you know, this label, and you think, oh, okay, it's debunked. That means everything's all right. That means things are moving forward. It's still a fight. There's still a fight. And in the state of Texas, we got this slogan, don't mess with Texas, but Texas consistently messes with me and it consistently messes with my fucking people. And so, yeah, Greg Abbott is a bitch, and we gonna keep moving.
Well, if you're tweeting along, Greg Abbott is a bitch.
Yes. Greg Abbott is a musty bitch.
Okay. Quotable. I forgot to ask y'all's permission. I don't keep a notepad or computer. All of my notes are on my phone, so I promise you I'm not texting or on TikTok. Is that okay? Okay. Awesome. I just want to speak briefly about the organizing landscape. Those of us who are abolitionists, those of us who are fighting against the death penalty, see ourselves as we march towards November, get dragged towards November. I don't know. When we look at the Republican platform, I know we've all heard of Project 2024 by now. Usually the Constitution is reserves criminal law for the states, right? It allows localities to sort of create criminal accountability as they see fit. But with the potential Trump regime, what we see, when he says small governments, he basically means no EPA or Medicare, but he means huge expansions to the Department of Justice's criminal division power. And that's really important. Because that means basically he can come in and override any local prosecutor if he doesn't deem the punishment severe enough, right? So the opportunity for the DOJ to be used as a political weapon against opponents is very real. He also talks about both expanding the death penalty and utilizing it, also clearing federal death row out, right? We saw in his last months of presidency, it was a bloodbath. He negating due process and executing people at an alarming rate. That's going to happen again once he's in office, right? And so making sentences harsher and increasing the use of death penalty. But also, of course, we see him expanding some criminal stuff around abortion, right? That you can be charged with drug offenses for mailing abortion pills to each other. And then we have the other side, the DNC platform that for the first time since 2012 took federal death penalty abolition off of its platform. The DNC's platform around criminal justice right now is actually right of what it was in 2020, right? In 2020, they were talking about decriminalizing marijuana. You don't see that. They say, no, you shouldn't be in jail for possession, but they took that language out. There used to be things around like needing to confront police accountability, police brutality. Now it's about we need to give police more funding. We need to give them more money, more training facilities. We need to support our folks in blue, right? And so we see this swing to the right of where the Dems were in 2020. It seems that criminal justice isn't the hot girl on the block anymore, right? Folks have moved away from it. Folks talk about democracy, all kinds of other things that are important issues. But we see they have long abandoned criminal justice work, even though we've seen an uptick in police violence every year since 2020. This year, there's been close to 900 people killed by the police, y'all. We are on track to surpass our numbers from the last 4 or 5 years. But we hear everyone racing back to these antiquated, tough-on-crime policies that they say make us feel safe. So I want to do an exercise with y'all. Is this cool? Can I do a quick little exercise with y'all? Okay, cool. Awesome. I love the thumbs up. I love the affirmations. Like I said, I'm a call and response girl. Oh, thank you. All right, I'm going to have y'all close your eyes. Don't go to sleep. I want you to picture a place that feels safe and secure and free from harm. Think about who's with you, what's around you. What does it look like? What does it smell like? A place where you feel warm and protected, safe. Think of the things that exist in that world, in that beloved community. All right, open your eyes. I would love it if some folks can popcorn. Just say out loud, what did you see in your visions of a safe community? Water? Okay, what?
Home.
Okay, thank you, sis. What else?
Garden.
Garden. Look.
The ability to show up as yourself.
Ashe, ashe. What else we got?
This conference.
Amen. Come on. Schools, right? Public education. Come on, gardens. Food, access to good food, right? These are things that make us feel safe. Yes, sis?
Recreation.
Okay, some parks, some playgrounds. As a mama, free childcare. You know, maybe my tuition wiped. No debt, no student loan debt. Abolish Sally Mae. No 7% mortgage rates. Come on, let's talk about it. That's what makes us feel safe and secure and warm, right? In any of your visions of safety and security, did you see bars, security cameras, borders, death chambers, cop cities? Hell no. But neoliberalism tells us that this is what makes us feel safe. And we have the vision of what actually makes us feel safe, right? We have more in common around the idea of safety than we do around anything else, right? And I think that is a beautiful place as an abolitionist to build from, this idea of a beloved community, of the things that actually make us feel safe. It isn't prisons, it isn't jails, it isn't cops. I didn't hear any of y'all say that. If you did, this might not be the space to be in. And so I think about this beloved community that we are trying to build together, that we are architecting together as abolitionists. And as a person in Atlanta, I think about 2020, Rayshon Brooks. Did y'all hear about Rayshon Brooks? Do y'all remember that story? The black man who was killed in the parking lot of a Wendy's, right? Murdered by the police, APD. He was drunk in his car. And I think, what would have happened if instead of calling the police, somebody would call them in a Lyft and a tow truck home, right? So building the beloved community of abolition beyond the carceral state, beyond death chambers and cop cities and death-making institutions is absolutely possible with individual activity. Sorry, I didn't mean to go off on this roof, y'all. It's I get real passionate talking about abolition, but it's possible.
No, thank you for that. And it's a great way for us to kind of just segue through this conversation. We've talked about the history of the death penalty. We've talked about how laws evolve post emancipation to continue to enslave and bind black bodies. And how today the death penalty is carried out exclusively almost on black and brown bodies. So when we look at this disparate treatment and when we figure out that the powers that be are going to continue to modify the laws of the land to oppress and cage us, what does a solution to this look like?
people will say, not many people are sentenced to death, right? People will say, why should we even care about the death penalty? I'm from Missouri. People will be like, y'all have the death penalty still when we're working on a campaign? Yes. It's not that widely known that they are still state sanctioning murders in gas chambers across this country. And so we in this room know why it is relevant, but I want to talk about what is the solution here? What does this panel see as the solution here and the next step?
I can talk a little bit about that. So overall, the solution is we need to dismantle white supremacy. I mean, right? The solution is we need to get rid of the capitalist structure, the people that literally make money off of our blood, off of our bodies, off of our debts. But that can only happen when we come together and we organize. And I know, you know, organizing and, you know, mobilizing, et cetera, are always these terms where a lot of us think that that means going outside and protesting, you know, getting your sign, getting your bullhorn, hitting the street. And there are times where that needs to happen. But also, we need to organize within this system to dismantle the system. Meaning, if like in Texas or Missouri, if 1,000 people came down to the state capitol on a day where they were having hearings about things, because they legislate our destruction, right? They are literally in Missouri State Capitol last year legislating whether they wanted to give people the death penalty who had committed child sex crimes because the law passed in Florida because DeSantis is a horrible person. So they literally will legislate our destruction, and guess who not in the room? Us. When I started going to my state capitol about 5 years ago, I said in a hearing one day, and I looked around, not only was I the only Negro in the room, I was the only person from St. Louis, because our capital is about 2 hours away. I was the only marginalized poor person. Everybody else in there was a legislator, a lobbyist, a person who, you know, was paying money to certain people. It was all this space of, we are going to make the laws and enact them upon the poor folks in St. Louis and Kansas City and rural Missouri. So we need to show up in those spaces. I've been starting to bring people to my own state capitol for that purpose, but we need to educate our folks on how this system legislates, the language that they use, the words may and shall. Go to your state statutes and look up statutes and see where it says may and shall. Because when it says may and shall, that means they ain't going to do a motherfucking thing for you. Okay? Because they may do it and they shall do it, but are they going to do it? Not necessarily. So we need to really, like, understand how these people talk, the language that they use. In this language, again, this is violence. Everything that they do that is violent looks like civility, you know, and looks nice. But we need to bring our people to these places. We need to organize, not only to get our folks in these offices, because there are a whole lot of cities with, you know, black mayors and black leaders, but we need to hold those folks accountable. Right, my own city, we have a black mayor today. Last summer we had within 6 weeks there were 3 deaths in our city jail, right? 3 deaths within 6 week period. One man died because he was medically neglected and some other things. So, and these were black folks who died, and we had a hearing, our city council hearing, and I came to the hearing, this is what I said. I said, everybody run the city black. The mayor black, the sheriff black, the warden black, the prosecutor black, the city attorney black, 90% of the CEOs in this jail is black. Why are black people still dying in here? It's because after we elected these people to their office, we went and sat down and thought we'd have did something because we got a black face in a higher place and ain't actually holding those folks accountable. So we need to organize to make sure we are holding the people that we put in office accountable. I know y'all got a black mayor in Chicago. Yesterday I was over at the Fred Hampton event, because I don't know if, and we should probably talk about this, but August 30th would have been Fred Hampton's 76th birthday. I was there yesterday and Brandon came and spoke, and that's the first time I ever heard a mayor say the word white supremacy. I actually looked up at him when he said it because I was shocked. I know. Right? So, and keep holding him accountable. And I don't know exactly how well he's doing, but just because we got our people in these places, we have to hold them accountable. That's what organizing means. So even after we get, quote unquote, the wins, we need to make sure we keep organizing, keep putting pressure. So I think that in order to fight this system, to get what we need, we're going to have to organize and infiltrate these spaces, and not just for performative or, you know, representation purposes, right, for to actually get the things that we need. I don't care about representation. I don't care if a black woman is elected to president. I wouldn't give two damns. Because like Sherelle just said, they ain't talking about the death penalty no more. But I care about whoever's in these spaces. We have to hold these people accountable. We have to organize. So that's what's going to take my state, Texas, Georgia, is us organizing and not assuming because we supported these people, we gave them a couple dollars, or we voted for them, etc., or we got on social media and defended them, that they're going to automatically do something for us. So go to your government offices, state, even local. The school board, every school board where there is a majority black children population should be filled with black folks in those rooms when they have those school board meetings, when they have your local council meetings, even like the utilities, when they're talking about raising your utility rates. We need to be in those spaces and understand what they're doing to us and understand the language that they're using, because they're going to keep on legislating our harm unless we know what's going on and we strategize and organize around that. So, you know, defeating white supremacy, everything that we need to do is going to take a strategy and an organized effort from all of us to make sure that we're in those spaces and we know what's happening and we're pushing back. So overall, that's kind of what I think about how we're going to defeat this.
For one, this is one of the heaviest questions I've had to answer in a long time. Solution. Do we have any? I know I see some organizers, but raise your hand if you're an organizer. Oh, yeah. You see how we give a fuck about our people? Very mindful. Very fucking mindful. See, I saw a lot of organizers, but has it been hard for you to dream? Raise your hands. Has it been harder for you to see the path forward? How many people have had some ease with that? Let me raise your hands. Maybe that'll be a better question to ask. See, yeah, so when I think of solutions, I think about us being out of the weeds for just a moment. Mm-hmm. Just a moment. Because when we in the weeds, we get reactionary. Yes. When we in the weeds, we start performing like activists in moments and not organizers. Sometimes we forget to develop leaders along the way. Mm-hmm. And I feel commissioned to name that. We have to develop leaders along the way. That is a part of the mandate. That is a part of the assignment. So when I think of solutions, as we stand today, something you can do in the next 10 days, 10 hours, 10 months is start developing leaders. Get back to it. Mm-hmm. Get back to it. We got to build our people up. Solutions. You know, when we dream, when we envision, we operate from that place and we're able to thrive within that. Systemic change is good. Systemic change is good. We love when our clemency efforts work in our favor. We love when we can, you know, even restore some rights for some formerly incarcerated people, some currently incarcerated people. But solutions look like out organizing the system. Mm-hmm. Out organizing the system and building something new. I don't know about y'all, but I'm tired of being fucking exploited. I'm tired of being exploited. And I'm sorry, I've been cursing a lot. I don't like to cuss on Sundays, but I'm doing it anyway. Mm-hmm. And we all know we cannot police our problems. We can't police our problems. We cannot continue to police our problems. If Sonya Massey had not called the police, she would be alive. It's quite that simple. Mm. If Sonya Massey had not called the police, she would still be alive. That's what we're facing, y'all. And we have people like the Democratic Party. We have individual leadership telling us what safety looks like. We have to do better at defining public safety for ourselves. And that's why I said, get out of those weeds. Because there's coming a time where we have to actually actualize some of what we were saying in 2020. It looks like the People's Response Act. It looks like these initiatives where we are developing the teams that can go out there and actually, in a way, protect our communities. In Dallas, there's an uproar happening right now. A police officer, he was beloved in the community. Omega Phi, he's part of the, you know, Divine Nine. Mm. And he was killed on a parking lot in a big nonprofit
Fort Oak Cliff, if anybody's familiar with it. He was killed in the parking lot. This was on Thursday, Wednesday or Thursday. And there's much uproar going on because he was a former educator. He mentored students by night, and he was a rookie cop. He was murdered by a young black man, 30 years old. He was murdered by him, and he was going through a mental health episode. I say that not to bring anything regarding a police officer being murdered, but I say that to say that their framing of what community policing looks like, it don't fucking work. It does not work. When you bring some of the best of the best out of community and put a uniform on them, when you put a cop city, that's what they're working on in Dallas, putting a cop city on UNT campus, $140 million investment. They currently have secured $90 million.
Shame.
But they can't secure $90 million to invest in what we actually say we need. So I wanted to bring some light and shed some light that we have a model of community, of what community looks like. We have a model of what actually keeps us safe. And if they would hear us, that officer might still be here today.
I wasn't planning on answering this question or popping in on here, but I saw how many organizers there were in the space. And I saw how many organizers there were that were feeling a bit defeated and or can't see past the next 20 feet. And as a mama with a black child on the spectrum who's downstairs, I want to say thank you for all of you who are showing up every day for your people. Not to romanticize it, but his future is the future of our young folks are depending on us to connect with each other, right? And it might feel impossible, speaking to the organizers, but our folks have been resisting for 500 years plus, ebbs and flows of this protracted struggle, right? At one time, getting rid of slavery seemed like an impossible task until it was. Getting rid of lynching seemed like an impossible task until it was. And so even though I hear my folks, who I don't assume are neoliberal or trying to be reformist, say, you know, since I'm with you on the vision of abolition, I'm with you in theory, but have you met people? Or my abusers inside and I want them coming home. What I'm hearing is that we still have work to do to make that thing real, right? My sister Derica often says, like, we might not know exactly where we're going, but we just got to start running because we know this isn't it. And so we have to keep organizing and building with each other. How many of y'all have cop cities that are being built in your communities that you know of? Okay, quite a few. Where are y'all from? Phoenix, Dallas, Philly, Chicago. I heard the other one. Oh, thanks. And so as I'm hearing all these different cities and places that are building cop cities, one thing is I don't have the solution, but I'm saying I'm here and I'm ready to work with you. I'm ready to build with you, to collaborate, to talk about what we've learned in Atlanta, what we're doing in New York. You can reach me at SherelleBrown13@gmail.com. Come up to me after. I'll give you your email. I'm here to collaborate and build the next thing together, right? We know that phrase, you can't dismantle the master's house using the master's tools, right? And our folks are like, okay, cool, but you ain't built the other thing yet. You ain't built the house, and I don't want to stand out in the rain. Mm-hmm. And so what are we building in the meantime is what I'm interested in as we're on our way to this sort of egalitarian, beloved community future. And I want to build that with y'all. So I mean that sincerely as an organizer. Come talk to me after. Let's collaborate. I don't have the solution, but I'm saying I'm here with you to work with you and to organize with you. And I thank y'all for showing up for our people.
I will, I'll chime in, and I do want to give space for to hear more about the Cop City work that you guys are doing in your respective states. But one of the things that I wanted to kind of point out, and I hear Sherelle, you say this a lot, that abolition is the tip of the spear. And I definitely want you to talk a little bit more about that. But you also asked, Don, you asked why is this relevant? Like, why should we care about the death penalty? And being a death penalty organizer for almost 10 years, one of the things that I have seen and one of the reasons that I think that everybody should care about it is because since the death penalty is such a polarizing issue, it's really easy to use it to expand the carceral state. and to diminish established rights using the death penalty, which some people might care about, some people may feel strongly about it, you know, but using the death penalty in that regard and then translating that erosion of rights all the way down, trickling it down. We've seen this in many of our states with the secrecy acts that have come out around the death penalty, where states have said, okay, it's so hard for us to get death penalty these lethal injection drugs. It's so hard because of these amazing organizers that are on the stage and in the audience that are doing the work. Nobody wants to sell us these drugs. The pharmaceutical companies, they don't want us to get their drugs to kill people. So we need to keep it a secret. We need to be able to run around in the dark of the night and get these drugs out of the back of driving schools, or mix it up in some sort of compound pharmacy and then have a box execution. We've seen that, and many states have been able to pass those laws, but today it's a state secret about where we're getting death penalty drugs, but it's a very slippery slope. Like, what's the next state secret that you just got to keep from the citizens? You've got to make an exception for FOIA. What is the next state secret? We've also seen this in Florida, where Aramis Ayala, she was a state's attorney in the 9th Judicial District in Florida. When she said that the death penalty was bad policy and she was not going to be seeking capital punishment, it was a waste of the resources of her office, then Governor Rick Scott reassigned any potential death penalty cases to another state attorney. So the governor comes in and he takes the power, which typically, if you were just prosecuting people, you would have unbridled power. Who was going to check you if you was the prosecutor, if you were doing that business? But when you say, hey, this is not a good policy for my location, we're not going to be seeking death penalty, then he goes and he takes those cases and takes that power away from a duly elected black woman state's attorney. The Supreme Court of Florida upheld him in that. We see in Memphis, where we talk about, and shout out to Councilman J.B. Smiley, I saw him last night, because Memphis has said that they are having problems and they need common sense gun control in their areas. There have been legislators in Tennessee that have threatened to stop state funding from going to Memphis if they seek to put in these common sense gun controls. And so we see the further erosion of our rights. We see the power that's being taken from communities and locations. We see it in Jackson, Mississippi, where they have created this whole another police force where they want to police the people of Jackson. So that's why I think it's important, because just like as goes the South, as goes the death penalty, we create these laws and then it kind of trickles down to where we have eroded our rights for something that a lot of people say, well, it doesn't really affect me, but now it does.
And that reminds me, they often tell us to defer in our process. Do it the right way. Go through the court system, right? Collect the ballot signatures, right? This is how you do the thing. And so, you know, they tell us this is how you do it. And when we're talking about death penalty cases, but somebody can come in, like Khalifa, I know we're going to get to it, can come in and change their mind and decide to push their weight around. And we see that, like, with the Cop City that said, you know, don't destroy property, guys. Don't block the highways. You know, take it to city council. We had several hours of folks coming to testify at city council every week, and they still said, nah, right? They said, oh, well, put it on the ballot. Voting, that's the way. Voting is the way. Went, collected the necessary signatures by some 60,000 over what the requirement was. And they still try to hold that up in court, right? So they tell us, go through the proper channels. This is the key. And then they change the locks on the door. And so we need both radical flanks and progressive flanks, I think, in movement work. Folks who are putting their bodies on the line, as they have done in Atlanta, to stop Cop City, along with continuing to push for the measures that they say are the appropriate routes. But I just wanted to highlight the hypocrisy of, like, folks saying this is how something's supposed to be properly done or handled, and then this shifts and move the goalposts when we try to go that route every time.
And because you said that, I just wanted to say rest in power to Tortuguita and all of the people who again have put their lives on the line for Cop City, for all of our struggles. You know, we just have so much going on today, and so many people are doing some amazing work, and definitely wanted to shout that out. Want to also talk about abolition being a tip of the spear. And if you all have not read Tip of the Spear by Dr. Orasami Burden, please go to that bookstore and get it. The Attica uprising was such a pivotal moment in the prison movement because it showed those in power that we had to step on these people's necks because we can never let this happen again. So please go get the book. Dr. Burden is amazing. And it is, you know, it's just a read that is necessary. Chapter 4 is hard because it talks about the sexual abuse that happened to the people who were rioting in Attica, but it is an amazing book. But again, back to tip of the spear. So when we talk about like our work and the death penalty and what that means to be tip of the spear, I always tell people organizing, you know, criminal justice movement, all of these things we have, it's also a hierarchy. Everything is a hierarchy, right? And so when we talk about the death penalty, it's literally like the lowest rung on a ladder in our space. Now, when we talk about reentry work, is amazing because people are coming home and should be doing better, so let's help them. And that's necessary and great, but also there are people that are in cages right now today. There are people that are on you know, death watches, death warrants. There are people who have LWOP, life without parole. That's another death sentence. And so even our folks that are in these cages, we also have to remember them, that they are at that lowest rung. In my work, even trying to like get people to support what I do, talking to someone about a person that possibly did commit some horrible act, right? They're still human. There's still value in them and their life. And so trying to convince folks of that can be a little bit difficult, but that's why I talk about like that hierarchy. So we talk about the death penalty being like the ground floor, let's deal with that. Because if we deal with the death penalty, the worst of the worst, right? All of the other things that are happening in our system have no choice but to get better because we're not degrading, murdering, killing, dehumanizing the people that we consider the worst of the worst. And so this work is always like that ground floor. I work with people in other parts of advocacy and organizing, et cetera, that do like drug sentencing, equalization, like the crack and cocaine disparity, right? We're trying to get that equal across the country. And a lot of people I work with won't touch the death penalty. It's not, you know, a friend of mine told me it's not glamorous. The work that I do is not glamorous. It's not on the front page of the papers. It's not something that CNN want to talk about unless they're, you know, of course, reporting how the state killed another person. So this work is definitely at that ground floor. And I think that if we dealt with that across our nation, everything else will definitely get better. There are about 2,000 people nationwide on death rows, but it is such the belly of that beast, that space where like a person is dehumanized to the point where their life is taken. And so we need to start there and work our way up. So I definitely think that death penalty is definitely the tip of the spear, that ground level of our abolitionist struggle. And like Sherelle had said earlier, we definitely need to address it. And I guess I can really talk quickly, since I'm talking about the death penalty, about Khalifa, if that's okay. Yes. I think it's a sign down here. So we all have on shirts that say death does not equal justice, free Khalifa. In my work in Missouri, there is a person on death row. His name is Marcellus Khalifa Williams. And I call him Khalifa because he's an imam, he's a man of faith. He took upon the name Khalifa during his Shahada, so I try to respect that. And he is scheduled to be executed September 24th, so what, 23 days away. The thing about his case, because I don't like the death penalty overall, I don't think this country should be killing anybody, because the people that founded this nation, nobody executed them, and they killed a whole lot of folks. But Khalifa is innocent. And when I say innocence, right, I don't mean just because he's my friend and I like him, I say he's innocent. He's innocent because the science says he's innocent. The DNA says he's innocent. All of the testing did not come back to him. The hairs that were in the victim's hand clutched when she was killed, they're not Khalifa's hairs, right? But this state decided that it had enough evidence, which were two informants that came forward because a $10,000 reward was put forward. So they had these two witnesses, you know, incentivized witnesses, and that was all they needed. These two poor black people came forward and said, Khalifa told us he did this. And because of that, they felt like they had enough evidence to convict him of this murder. And it was a tragedy. There was a woman who lost her life. However, it's another tragedy to execute somebody that's innocent. So we've been advocating for Khalifa. We had a court date last week where it was revealed that the prosecutor had mishandled the evidence. The prosecutor's DNA is on the murder weapon, because he'd been touching it and passing it around and doing what he wanted to do with it, right? So, I mean, I said, well, if his DNA on the murder weapon, maybe he done did it. I mean, like, you know, if we just saying stuff, you know what I'm saying? But, like, really, you know, they asked him why his DNA is on the murder weapon. He's like, well, I took it out the bag and I touched it and handed it. You know, I do that all the time. So, in this case, there was so much mishandling, but this state is still trying to kill Khalifa. And when we talk about innocence, people are like, oh, well, they're going to stop it because, you know, he's innocent. These people kill innocent people every day, do they not? What crime did George Floyd commit? Not a one, right? Breonna Taylor didn't commit no crime. The state killed her, right? And they just said recently the judge dismissed the case against the cop in Breonna's case and said her boyfriend caused her death. Because we're always going to blame it on, you know, black folks and marginalized people. And in his case, yes, they killed innocent people. They've killed two or three innocent people since I've been in this work in my own state. So we're really trying to amplify Khalifa's case, his story, teach people that whatever we are doing in our criminal justice system, killing innocent people should be like our, you know what I'm saying, our boundary, right? We should not be killing innocent people. Like, that should be the bare minimum that we ask of our government. And so it's just a really horrible thing that's happening with Khalifa, and it's exemplary of so many other cases that happen across the country, because when you're black, when you're poor, when you're marginalized, they're always going to put their, you know, either physical or literal boot upon your neck. So I would love for you all to go to freekhalifa.org, learn about him, share on socials. A couple of people have made TikToks, etc. We're trying to get us to really amplify the case. When I think about Khalifa, you know, the visions of Troy Davis come to my head often, and so many people fought to save Troy, and the state of Georgia still murdered him. And we have to get to a place where we stop this. We stop this atrocity. We stop innocent lives from being taken. We stop all lives from being taken by the powers that be. So again, Khalifa is an amazing person. He's a poet. We have a booth, a table downstairs with more information. But please learn about him, share the story. You all can get involved as far as in your own communities, because when you educate your people, that helps us so much in this death penalty space. So I just wanted to bring Khalifa and his story and his life, because his life definitely matters, and we are trying to do our best to save him. Free Khalifa!
Free Khalifa. I'll just add, in my organizing, I oftentimes feel like death penalty is not that issue that's at your front door, but it's the one that's in your backyard. And I'm always reminding people that they have this, especially in the South, they've gotten really crafty with lynching people in private. Folks don't even know it's an execution happening that day. Like, that's what we're running up against. I mean, like I said, it's not that issue at your front door, but it's happening in your backyard, and it is equally important. Human life is equally important, especially in a city like Dallas, where we had the first criminal integrity unit, where this unit was created. And I mean, from the time it was created, so many exonerees have come out of Dallas County. If you look into some of our stats in race, you'll see the number around that. But I also want to name that we don't just fight for people who are innocent or have innocence claims.
Yes.
We value human life.
Period.
Very, very mindful. We value human life. And I think it's necessary to name that at times. I also, a huge part of my organizing takes place in religious spaces. I mean, it's the Bible Belt, you guys, and faith-based spaces. And most people, they pull from scriptures and they find these situations where someone's innocent and it's this and this. But I always speak about Barabbas. Barabbas is this guy who historically who came in, and he was notorious for being a murderer. He was indisputably guilty. And that cross that, you know, Jesus, as some might know him as, was made for Barabbas. And they say, you know, who do we want to offer up? Who we want to offer up? They said, we're going to take Jesus instead of Barabbas. And so that teaches you that people can pick and choose it's arbitrary, is what I want to name. Our system is very arbitrary. And that tree is not meant for nobody. That cross is not meant for nobody. And when you did it to them, I mean, when you didn't do it for them, you did it to me. I truly believe that. And that is why we doing the work that we doing in the South, and it's so necessary, and I have to be strategic at times, and there are moments where, we have to go into these churches, talk to these mega pastors, and we have to get people behind us to stop these executions in real time. And I needed to name that. Yeah, we're not just advocating for those who are innocent, but those who are guilty also. It is very necessary that we abolish the death penalty. It's very necessary that we weaken the carceral state by any means necessary, and however that has to look, case by case by case by case. And we're also with the Eighth Amendment Project, who from a national scale are operating from a political lens to abolish the death penalty that way. But in our states, it looks very case by case at times. So if I offer that because in your state, I'm almost certain that there is a death penalty organization that you might want to get connected with. I know you're focusing on Cop City. I know you're focusing on the Palestinian movement. I know you're focused on something, but you might want to include the death penalty. Like I said, it's in your backyard. It's happening. It's happening. But get in proximity and organize. Organize, organize, organize.
I'll just add, when I talk about the death penalty being the sharpest edge of the iceberg, it's because when we get rid of the death penalty, it makes it possible for us to do so much other work, right? So when the death penalty doesn't exist, we see less faulty plea bargains. Do folks know how much we spend on one death penalty case? Any guesses? $2 million. $2 million for a single death penalty case because of due process. That's money we could be using for other things. All the beloved visions that we had earlier about what makes us feel safe. And we decided to connect these issues around both death penalty and Cop City because we see both of these things as death-making institutions. We know that to be so because they already claimed a life. Again, rest in peace to Tortuguita. Do you guys know what goes in, what Cop City entails, like the kinds of things that they're building? It's a mock city for them to sort of like play urban warfare. And so there's like a fake grocery store, a fake school, some buildings they can scale down with their military-grade equipment, right? There's a Black Hawk helicopter pad that they're building at this $100 million facility, right? And all these things they're doing in concert with international bodies like the IDF, right? And so as our oppressors are learning from each other, literally both practices and weapons, so too we must learn together how to resist against these systems. And so I just wanted to make that connection clear between these death-making institutions that it all got to go. It all got to go.
I got one last chime in. Y'all, they are criminalizing our work. I think we got accustomed to, they criminalizing our bodies. They're criminalizing our reproductive organs. They're criminalizing our people. They're criminalizing us. But our work is being criminalized. Like, to have the title of organizer is criminalized. When in Atlanta, people are getting charges of RICO charges, racketeering charges. In Dallas, Texas, there are several cases that are happening right now just to organizers doing the work. White folks that's out here just trying to do common good and organize some people out of jail, get them, bail them out. These are people, church going people, and they just want to help the community. They getting locked up too. So now this is the time that I hope you know who your brother and your sister is. I hope you know who your comrades are. This is not the time where, in 2020 or in before, where criminal justice was becoming the thing and it was sexy to be an organizer. No, this is the time. Well, this work, I'm being honest with you, you got to live by it and you got to be willing to die about it. Because the level of criminalization of just us doing the work, that's not even to say the day-to-day stuff that we're actually organizing up against. So I just hope you know, we all are taking into account what it means to be an organizer and what it means to organize in these times. We got an X on our back and we being targeted in rates that I cannot explain. I felt the need to name that.
Yes, and before we go to questions, like, y'all, I'm always fangirling when I get to be with this group of individuals because they do such tremendous work, and doing death penalty work is has to be just by virtue of the nature of the death penalty, it has to be intersectional. And so I would love, before we open up for questions, if you guys could briefly talk about some of the other issues that you're working on, to let people know, you know, just how intersectional and how deliberate you are about building coalitions with other issues and other groups.
Yeah, I'll kick us off. In defense of Black lives, I'm going to be real, we dealt with some harm a couple years into after the uprisings. There was some major harm that happened within my organization. So there's a lot of rebuilding happening in defense of Black lives. However, we are extremely rigorous in our approach and how we do that. We are also taking more holistic approaches to transformative justice. But our day-to-day work, we're doing some Cop City initiatives, throwing down with Danita on some cannabis reform work. But at the core of everything we do, I named this earlier, is developing leaders. We never want to get away from leadership development. You never want to get away from one-on-ones. You never want to, it's too much transactions happen within this work that I've been seeing, and this work is totally relational. A lot of transactions take place, but the work is and will always be relational. You need to know somebody. You don't need to always be the social, you need to know a social worker. You need to know who work up in that office. We've gotten into direct service when that's not what we're called to. So at my organization, that's what we're focused on, is developing leaders, not just folks who can do the transactions, not just people who can show up and be bodies that to be accounted for. No, developing leaders.
I appreciate this question. I'll be brief. So again, most of my work for the last 15 years has been in anti-Black state violence, defining that around death penalty, police work, mass incarceration. But now, as a mom of a three-year-old, I also have been heavily invested more in the fight around public education. I truly see it as one of the battlegrounds that we're going to be contending for in the coming years. You guys remember Pat Robertson, the televangelist kind of, yeah. My grandma used to watch him on TV. So the Christian fascist right, since his time, for the last 30 years, have been building their fights locally around school boards. And we're now seeing their organizing work come into fruition, right? They've been organizing around this for the last 30 years. And so I'm very interested in the response we make to that as we see an attack on our young people, how they can show up and identify in schools, how they are seen, what they get to learn, and how that leads into mass incarceration. So my work is at the intersections of public education. I love organizing with youth. I get to do that in the state of New York and in Atlanta with young folks who are pushing back against metal detectors and bringing restorative justice circles into their schools. And so if you're interested in that, come talk to me. But yeah, anything around state violence and our young people, that's where you'll find me.
ML?
So real quick, again, like I said, my work revolves around incarceration, the incarceral system, prison industrial complex. So I do everything around that. Now, I will say there are so many intersections. Sherelle just mentioned children. I do a lot of work with the youth because Black children, Black boys who don't read on a third grade level are exponentially more likely to go to prison when they get a little older, right? So I do so much work with our youth because they are our future. I had a conversation with a 13-year-old about a month ago, and he inspired me. I'm talking to him. He's like, oh, yeah, George Stinney. And I'm like, yeah. You know, so, like, our babies are definitely where we need to be pouring into them, raising them. Frederick Douglass said it's better to build strong children that repair broken men. And so that's definitely something that I live by, and supporting our youth, getting them involved, having conversations with them. Kids are not stupid. You know, I know that it has to be age appropriate, but talk to the kids about the issues that are happening, and they have amazing perspectives. So, you know, the children is one area that I love to work with and work with the kids. Also, the intersections of being queer, gay, trans people exist. They exist in prisons. January 3rd of 2023, Missouri killed Amber McLaughlin. Amber was the first openly trans person in this country that was murdered. I'm sure she wasn't the first trans person, but nobody else had been open before that time. And people ask me, oh, well, is she saying that to get sympathy and support? I said, our governor's a racist. He's still going to kill her, right? Which he did. So her being open in who she was just in those last months of her life wanting to be recognized and respected on who she was. And so I did that, and I cursed people out who didn't want to respect that. So, you know, all of those identities exist. Disabled people are in prisons. I was one of them. We exist as well. So everybody, I have a right now trans friend incarcerated, and she's been there over 30 years. So all of these identities exist in within this space, and we have to understand that whatever we're doing out here, prison is a microcosm of that, and we need to make sure that we're reaching out to those folks on the inside, right, who inhabit all of these different identities. So that's what a lot of my work entails, not only the death penalty, but the prison system as far as like solitary confinement, things like just the violence, the medical neglect. You know, I'm trying to help so many people who are being severely medically neglected who are in prison. My own loved one, his cellmate right now, basically thinks he's finna die. And, you know, I'm trying to help him and his family. So all of those things that are inside the incarceral system. Also education, anything that has anything to do with our carceral system, where the money going, because you know they embezzling like hell, so we're trying to figure out those things about the money that the people inside raise. So all of those things are involved in my work. Lastly, I'll say downstairs at our table as well, I created a campaign with my organization called Triple Digit Deaths. Five of the last 6 years in Missouri DOC, over 100 people have died in the custody of the department. And don't nobody want to be held accountable. Don't nobody want to talk about why we're doing an autopsy and you never see the results of the autopsies. So we're really trying to hold our DOC and also our legislature accountable for the fact that these people are dying. Every other department of our state, education, social services, etc., they have oversight. If anything happens in those departments, they are held accountable. DOC is the only place where they get like free reign to do whatever they want to anyone and never held accountable. So the Triple Digit Deaths campaign is something I started to amplify all of those people. Y'all probably walk past there and these like little decorative trees down there on the tables. Those are the names of the people that have died in our prison system. We had a little memorial one day, and I wrote the names down to be recited, and a pastor prayed over them. Then I felt bad about throwing them away, and so I decided to like make this like grieving tree because those families are grieving. I've talked to mothers and sisters and family members of people that have died in DOC, and they're questioning why and why nothing is being done about it. So all of those issues within the carceral system, not just in Missouri, actually across the country, a federal system. I work with people in other states as well. So I'm really trying to like get to a place where this system of incarceration is one of our largest areas of movement because it has to be dealt with. If you all knew what happened behind those walls and those bars and those cages, y'all would be in the street every damn day. It's that bad. It's really that bad. But you know, we just don't see it, right? Because we saw what they did to George Floyd. We all saw it on video. They do that every day. We don't see it though, right? And they hide it. They hide it purposely. So that's basically what my work is, trying to bring attention to the carceral system. And I do it unapologetically. I do it from a Jacksonian perspective. May he also rest in heaven. He was killed August the 21st. 71, and so I take the lessons from those that came before me and fight this system. And you know, that's kind of, like I said, that's kind of what I do.
Thank you.
For Rhonda, really quick, if I can, and just in the interest of time, because we want to hear from you, we will maybe have time for about two or three questions. So while for Rhonda is sharing the intersections of her work, if anyone who has anything to ask of this panel will line up at the mic, we'll try to get those in as quickly as we can.
Some days I'm a lawyer, and I get so frustrated with how the criminal legal system treats people that have not been accused but have not been proven guilty of any crime. So I'm working on some bail reform. We're working on the Noose to Needle campaign to combat the literal whitewashing of history, to show the historical context of how we got to where we are today. So follow us, Noose to Needle, on Instagram, all the socials. Go ahead.
Hey all, my name is Viral. I'm based here in Chicago. Thank you all so much for all the work you do and for this panel. It was so informative. So I wanted to share a little bit of the complexity that I've seen in the work we're doing here in Chicago and in Illinois, where we've built coalitions in the city and across the state to do amazing things across race, across gender, across class. But we've also seen times where that coalition breaks down, where you know, folks oppose various different measures of what to be changed. We've seen the president of the Transit Workers Union say we need cops on every train. We've seen Black Alder say, no, the Cop Academy on the West Side is a great thing. It's a jobs program, right? It's going to be great. This is what we need. We've seen Black faith leaders say, oh, we need these surveillance cameras everywhere because my people don't feel safe coming to church and stuff like that. And they'll often attack folks like myself and a lot of the non-Black leftists in this room as saying, oh, you're a bunch of outside agitators. You don't know the Black community. You shouldn't speak on any of these topics. So what would you say to folks like myself who are not Black but want to stand with you and want to fight on all of these issues when we get attacked by these, you know, people who launder for the ruling class by weaponizing their Blackness?
Just to start, I say stand steadfast, because they say the same things to us sometimes. I'm going to pass the mic. Stay steadfast, because we face the same things with people, because all skin folks ain't kin folks, and so we see a lot of that as well.
I'll be quick. Thank you so much for that question. Coalition work is hard, right? Yeah. We often, in the death penalty space, are working with folks who aren't with us on any other issue. They call MLK an outside agitator. It is such a neoliberal talking point to get folks to see each other's enemies. They did it in Atlanta when folks came and got arrested there defending Lonnie Forrest, right, and said, these are just outside agitators. These aren't our good Negroes. These are people coming from outside and agitating and stirring this stuff up. Inoculation with our people, right? Actual relationship building. Sometimes, when all folks have our hammers, everything looks like a nail, right? And so when folks say, we need this because of this, think through what else can we talk about? How else might that need get met, right? Building before we get to the coalition space around what are the needs that you're saying haven't been met by this vision of abolition. There's stuff in there as organizers that we need to be listening to and paying attention to. It's good data. It's good data to say, oh, this might be what we need to inoculate against. So how can we think through the talking points to the response, the relationship building that needs to happen so that there's trust around this other idea that there's something else possible? I know this is a very quick answer and would love to talk to you a bit more after, but I really appreciate that question.
I'll just add this real quickly. Center those mostly impacted. Build with those most impacted, because you cannot take their stories away from them. You need people who are from that community. You need to build within. You need to build within. Don't stray from your analysis and don't stray from your assessment also. And then I'll also just add, sorry, I had one more point, but I lost it.
I think the same. I definitely think you have to connect with those who are impacted. Find, you know, the organizations and the organizers that are on the same page with you, right? And work with them. So, again, in my city, there are a whole lot of Black women who are in power, right? And so, as the one person who was our prosecutor, I said something about her. She didn't know who I was. They know I was, and they called me racist. So when she met me, she's like, oh, right? You can't do that. That don't matter. You racist, misogynist. I am who I am, and I'm still going to call you out. So you really have to work with those folks, join those coalitions, find the people who agree with you, who, you know, share the same ideology, and work with them so that they can push back. And in your own community, because I know a lot of, like, there's sometimes there are white folks who are out of pocket. I go get my white people, because I ain't finna deal with you, right? I'm just saying, so I will call. I'm like, hey, go get your folk. Right? Mm-hmm. So you really have, in my line, I did this one right here, I do that to her all the time. Go get your peoples. Mm-hmm. So really have to, like, make sure that you're in community with everybody who can inhabit any, you know, identity, right? And make sure that you know, when you get pushed back, those folks that you are in community with are going to have your back in those moments.
Sorry, the last point came. Look for models that are happening across the country, internationally. Continue to educate, because oftentimes there's a disconnect in education, and we don't like to do that work. But continue to educate. Dads on duty in, what is that, New Orleans, where they just put dads in the place of officers, eliminated crime, right? Mm-hmm. Look for models that are working. There are people that are communities that are already living in that future that we want to live in. Then typically they're well-resourced.
Thank you so much. Just really quickly for people recording, I personally don't want to be recorded, so I appreciate you respecting that. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate your comments. This has been a really wonderful panel, a good learning experience. I also just appreciated the comments about RICO and organizing, as well as the startling rate of error related to the death penalty. My question really relates to JLWAP, LWAP sentences and how you fold those conversations in. A lot of times, A lot of times in the work, right, people hone in on what sometimes get called active death penalties, people on death row. Mm-hmm. And what happens, at least in my experience, what happens is that then the conversation sometimes turns to, and this is where I think that that abolitionist politic is really important, turns to, well, okay, if we're not going to put them on death row, we will kind of twist that into, or we will change that into an LWAP or JLWAP sentence. And that's actually not the goal, right? Because they're the same. And so I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or strategies about how you've been able to fold that information in to the conversations that you're having around death penalty work writ large, and not just death penalty as in people on death row specifically. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I guess I'll start real quick, and that definitely is a issue we have because, you know, in life sentence is a death penalty. It's a slow death, but it's still death penalty. So what I have two different conversations. What I say to like elected officials, because I have spoken to several who say, oh yeah, we can get rid of capital punishment as long as we have LWAP, right? And this, and they're like, well, will I even vote for it as long as there is a severe punishment? And the conversation that I have with them is the fact that a person is not the same person that they are 15, 20 years later. And statistics actually show that once a person has been incarcerated, minimum 15 years, max 20 years, their rate of recidivism is drastically lower, right? So we actually need to create a system where people do have a chance. And, you know, having those conversations with elected officials, with people who are in positions of power, to have them understand that even though a person did something wrong, we don't throw people away. I don't throw anybody away, even if they've done something, you know. And a lot of times people have done something at 18, 19, 20, 21. By the time they 40, 45, it's a whole nother person. So those are conversations to have. And we're trying to get things in my state like geriatric parole passed. And it's funny, one of our electors, real quick, trying to do this hearing about geriatric parole, he goes, well, I'm 65 and I could kill somebody. And I said, well, you shouldn't be telling nobody. You know what I mean? Like, stop. Why are you telling people that? But, you know, so like talking those conversations, geriatric parole, things like medical in prison goes way up when we're talking about elderly people, right? When we're talking about making sure that they have support in when they're incarcerated. So the LWAP is definitely something that we need to deal with nationally, but also on the other side, I have a conversation with just regular people, organizers, and like Sherelle said earlier, if we got rid of the death penalty, we would have so many other resources, even legally, right? All of the lawyers that work death penalty cases, the capital habeas units, Innocence Project take death penalty cases, and other entities, they can then work on those LWAP cases, those other innocent cases. The cases of people, I have a person in my state, his name is Joseph Williams, he got 741 years, okay? That's his sentence, right? So if we can take those legal resources out of fighting for, you know, people on death row and putting that somewhere else, that would help tremendously. So even every aspect of what we do, if we got rid of capital punishment, the other areas can be addressed, including LWAP. And I don't want people to think that it is a replacement for the death penalty. It's not. My organization used to be called Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. When I came into the organization, I wanted to know what alternative was. And it was LWAP because we were trying, at that time, they were trying to be like neutral and, you know, trying to bring in a conservative voices, right? It didn't work though, because this was several years ago. We still had a death penalty when I came into org. I said, well, let's stop sugar coding shit and call it what it is. I want to abolish the death penalty, right? So like speaking truth to power and making sure that we take the resources that we have and put them to people who have extended sentences. But LWAP is a slower death sentence, and that should not be overlooked. That's a conversation, and we need to make sure we keep that in the forefront.
For sake of time, I'm just going to drop a quick resource because I know we got to wrap up to that amazing question. You probably saw that energy amongst the panelists because those of us who've been in the death penalty space have been dealing with this question for the last 15 years. The death penalty space has predominantly been a very white-led space. And so what you see up here, these leaders, black folks who are leading in this space, is a newer thing in terms of like wanting to shift resources and make good on
some of the things that the death penalty movement got wrong. So I say that to say, join the Leaders of Color working group we have around folks who are wanting to answer that question around what about LWOP after we get rid of the death penalty. Come and talk to us. We meet monthly, and we'd love to have more folks and leaders tending with that question around LWOP.
My last thing is we weaken the carceral state, y'all. We chip away at the system. We don't like hearing that shit all the time, but that's what it is. We have to weaken it. We have to chip away at it little by little. I tell my director, my vision don't stop at just ending capital punishment. It doesn't stop. My ancestors didn't stop it, just stop lynching us, right? But we keep going and we keep operating from that place of vision. So it's always necessary to know that, yeah, how do we get away from life without parole? Continue to keep thinking in that regard as the resources free up, the capacity frees up in those other ways. We're now able to work our ways out of life without parole also.
Thank you guys all for hanging tough. Give it up for this panel, everybody.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.